Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Welcome, everybody, to the property planner, buyer and professor. I'm practicing the way that Pete says it. I welcome my two co-hosts and wonderful buddies. And today we've had a little bit of a chat before we've pressed record just to marvel at this crazy market for my market, which is Victoria and specifically Melbourne at the moment. We're not allowed to go regional. We've got 5 and 10 minute inspection windows and they've all got to be booked in, and it's been the most administration heavy week I've ever had in my life. So that's my market update. I want to hear something else. So Pete, you were chatting about a study that you've been doing. Please share.
Yeah. So study is probably too big a word for it. So the ABS stats came out last week. So what I did was have a look at how long it's taken each capital city's house prices to double. Would you like to hazard a guess on average, Dave, how long do you reckon it's taken for property prices to double?
On average across all the capital cities? Yeah. 12.5 years.
I'm going to guess.
Go on. Okay.
9.7.
All right. Dave, that's pretty good, mate, because on average it took 12 and a quarter years.
Wow.
But it's a big range. So starting at the bottom of the list, Brisbane took 16 years for property prices to double. Next was Adelaide at 15 and three quarter. Equal fifth was Perth and Darwin at 15 and a half. Then it was Canberra at 14 and a quarter. Hobart at 13 years. Melbourne at 12 years. And the winner is, did you hear that drum roll? Sydney. Only took Sydney 8 years for property prices to double.
Interesting. I would love to look at some segments of Sydney's growth, because if we did a special on the Olympics, if we look at post-Olympics, there's no doubling in that.
No, I had a quick look before. Like the index number in 2003 was the same as it was in 2008. Now, it went up and down a little bit, but basically property prices did not move at all for those 5 years. But the last 8 years have been in stark contrast to what happened to Sydney straight after the Olympics.
Oh, incredible. So what you've done, just so that our listeners understand and that I've got it right, you've taken a point in time from today and gone back to when values were half of that.
So I've gone to June 2021 because that's the most recent house data that I can get, and then I've gone back to see when they were half that. That is absolutely correct.
I would love to see what that retrospective analysis looks like a decade ago. It would be very different because Perth was flying. And Sydney.
Yeah, I can do that for next week. So what do you want me to do? Check out what happened in 2020.
Yeah, rinse and repeat for 10 years prior.
Okay, done. I'll do that for next week.
Exciting. Dave, what's your market update?
So it's been a big week. The potential for APRA to step in and make some changes.
Yeah, I've seen that in the headlines, yes.
Yeah, so the financial regulators are working on plans to potentially clamp down on a jump in high debt-to-income ratios among borrowers. This is something we've talked about in the last month or so. So in particular, the number of people whose mortgage loans, the debt level is 6 times greater than their income, has jumped from 16% 12 months ago to 22%. Now, so it's almost 1 in 4 people. Now, this is a trend that's exacerbated by lower mortgage rates, which enables people obviously to borrow larger amounts because, in essence, their repayments are lower. That's why that's occurring. But they're obviously concerned if rates go up, there could be some systemic problems within the marketplace with people holding too much debt. Yeah, they're just saying they need to be mindful of the balance between the credit income growth to prevent the build-up of future risks. So, yeah, the writing was on the wall when two of the bank CEOs fronting a parliamentary committee last week actually were talking about curbing lending, whether they got the tap on the shoulder behind the scenes prior to Josh Frydenberg coming out this week and stating that, you know, APRA should look into this or not, who knows, but it's not common for bank CEOs to be talking down their own business.
No, it's not, is it? Very interesting.
And profits. Yeah. So, yeah, so that might take, you know, that might take a month. It might take a few months before they come out with what path they want to go down. But they tend to take a pretty simple approach. The concern is it's mostly investors they're worried about who tend to borrow at these higher levels relative to their income across multiple properties. And they don't really want to impact first-time buyers, but they like to take a simplistic approach generally, so not to create too much red tape or loopholes. So we'll see what they do, whether they just restrict, you know, the number of borrowers who can borrow six times their income. Matt Comyn from CBA said, why don't, which was Kate's suggestion early at the start of the year, cap the assessment rate at a higher level. CBA recently moved theirs up in June to 5.25%, so he probably thinks he's already done his job and is why he wants them to take that pass. So, yeah, look, we've talked about it a fair bit during the year, haven't we? And looks like something might come into place prior to the end of the year.
Well, I think Kate's idea was an excellent one, because then really the only loans that are being given are the less risky loans, because they can more than afford it. Yeah, yeah. Rather than affecting everybody. You know, your benchmark is up this, you know, higher, and if you can afford to get the loan, fantastic, which doesn't penalise everybody else. Kate, yeah. You got a market update?
You guys have just put me on this little pedestal, Kate Bakos for head of IMF. I love it. look, I do, and it's the same issue. I've had journalists calling during the week saying, you know, having all kinds of angles, and the way that journos think is fascinating because they've got to get a story out. And, you know, one angle was, do you think we're going to see this market crash? I'm like, no, we're not going to see a market crash. That's not the intent. You know, they're wanting to slow the rate of growth. They're not wanting to turn the growth around from positive to negative. And secondly, I had someone ask me, you know, do you think investors are going to get picked on again? And interesting that we'd put investors in the gun because they haven't been so far, and nor should they be. And my concern about derailing investment activity is we've just started getting investors back and we have a housing shortage crisis. We've got rents going up. And I feel for our head of monetary policy people because they've got to balance all of these really precarious situations. If we get rid of investors, we'll continue to see rents soaring and we'll be hurting the people that need help the most. So I think it does circle back to managing the servicing. But interestingly, I saw a stat on LVRs and the loans that we're seeing at the moment, the maximum LVRs, so 90 plus is how they segregate LVR. We've seen a decline in the rate of 90 plus LVR lending. And that's really interesting. What that means is even if people wanted to borrow more, they're resisting going over 90, or the banks are resisting giving them over 90. So that says to me, when we've had a deterioration in the number of higher leveraging loans, that people aren't acting with that same desperation as they were in previous months, or the banks have already started to cool their willingness to take on highly leveraged lending. So I don't think that we should have a sudden jolt in terms of our policy when it comes to slowing things down, because we could really oversteer the ship again. I think it's going to take careful balancing and maybe just slowly easing up the buffering rate. I think that's the way that they'll need to do it, and that's what I've shared.
All government policy's job is to oversteer the ship, isn't it?
Well, that's certainly a consequence. Hopefully unintended, but it's certainly a consequence.
Let's spin that wheel. Hang on, we're going the wrong direction again. I think the reason we'll be having the lower above 90% will be directly correlated to the first-time buyer numbers reducing significantly. They tend to be the people who are borrowing above 90%. Most investors aren't able to borrow above a 90% LVR. So that, you know, will probably be why that correlation is occurring at the moment. Yeah, and they definitely do want to target investors and multi-property owners.
I've got to say, though, when I'm out there bidding, I know who's breaking the records and smashing things because I ask. I ask the agents, who was that buyer? What was that all about? And every time it's been an upgrader. It hasn't once been an investor.
Well, and well, they've got plenty of equity, haven't they? Because they've got, already got their own home, so now they're just moving up. So it's just a matter of whether their income can sustain an upgrade in their principal place of residence.
Do you know what's really smashing it? It's when they're getting gifted amounts of money from parents, and obviously if that's the foundation of their deposit for their loan, then they've got the ability to really leverage hard if they can service that. And so I occasionally go up against a cashed up first home buyer and get blown out of the water, but more often than not, it's an upgrader in the inner ring suburbs.
Yeah, I would agree. That's what I'm seeing as well.
We've got a really exciting part B today to follow on with. So I'm really pleased we've left ourselves a bit of time to chat about it. We're still talking about supply and demand drivers and in relation to location. And last week we finished off on streetscape and the visual aspects. And today we're getting into planning regulations, all things from what you can and can't do with the property, the impact of heritage listing. And I think this is a really meaty segment of this particular topic because planning regs play a huge part on the pricing and desirability of a property, and obviously that's related to the purpose. So, Pete, I'll start with you. Are you happy to chat overall about planning regs and in particular heritage listing in terms of supply and demand?
Sure. So in regards to heritage listings and supply, generally there's not many properties that are heritage listed. Now, they could be heritage listed because of the architectural style. Sometimes it's because somebody famous lived there and you wouldn't know just from looking at the place. And there is national heritage, which is very hard to get residential properties on the National Heritage Register. And then there's state heritage and local heritage. Then there's lesser like contributory items, or they call it different things in different states. But the supply of heritage property is relatively limited. But so is the demand, because if it's heritage listed, depending if it's local or state, will determine what you're allowed to do and not to do with the property. Generally speaking, you won't be allowed to touch the front of the property, how it looks from the street. If you want to do an internal renovation, in many cases, that's okay. If you want to do an extension at the back that nobody can see really from the front, that's okay. But generally speaking, the facade of the property needs to stay the same. In some cases, the whole property needs to stay the same. So even though there's a limited supply of heritage listed properties, there's also a limited demand because of the restrictions on what you can do with it. So really, property prices don't zoom up on heritage listed properties for those particular reasons. But what can really affect property price is the zoning. That is the council rules. Imagine an intersection and there's four blocks, each 1,000 square metres, and each one is 25 metres by 40 metres. They could have four different zonings. They could have four different values because of the development potential. Even though you might have a lot of land, council regulations can limit the supply of property on that land through zoning. So people need to be aware when they're buying property, even if they have no intention of developing, if you're in a very developer-friendly zone and the houses are like 40, 50 years old or more, then there's a good chance that you're going to have medium to high density development around you. So you need to consider that when purchasing your property.
Really good points. And you've almost jumped the gun with the zoning and development. We'll come back to that. I'm going to circle back into heritage. And you touched on it, heritage listed and a heritage overlay are two very different things. A heritage listing, as you said, it's usually in a noteworthy building, a historical building. I remember years ago when I first started work out of uni, I graduated in chemistry. So, of course, I went and worked for a chemical giant, and I was based in the city here in Melbourne at 1 Nicholson Street with Orica. And that building, 18 stories high, was Melbourne's first skyscraper. If you're hanging around up near Spring Street and you happen to see it, it's not a very sexy building. It's pretty daggy looking, but it's got a heritage listing on it. And I remember there was talk about that site being sold. And the prices that they were talking and the offers they were fielding were not representative of what you'd get for a building that doesn't have that heritage listing on it, because obviously they would have been restricted with what they could do with that site. So it is an interesting one, and it's not always a positive. It means that it's to be protected. But a heritage overlay is quite different. We see all kinds of activity in locations where there's a lot of heritage overlays. And Dave, you're not a stranger to this. You're living in the heartland of a suburb that has beautiful properties and lots of heritage overlays, but you also see a lot of redevelopments where there aren't overlays. So I'll get you to chat about the impact of a heritage overlay.
Well, look, a heritage overlay means that it's much harder to create new properties in that location, and you then also tend to have a greater consistency of the existing style of properties, which tends to have a certain charm and architectural appeal. Often the fact they're heritage, they're on older streets, which often are tree-lined and have, you know, beautiful trees along them that have been in existence for 50, 7500 plus years. Bigger blocks as well, generally speaking, so they become highly sought after. And that all feeds into why one of the major, I guess, challenges for maintaining property values to be reasonably affordable to the average person is more difficult when there are these sorts of regulations or restrictions around development of new properties.
Yeah, a heritage overlay is such a double-edged sword. And I find in my line of work, when you've got a heritage overlay, it doesn't guarantee you that you've got a beautiful streetscape, by the way. I've seen heritage overlays on ugly things as well. Usually it's a precinct or it's a blanket sort of heritage overlay. And when you look on the register, it has a number assigned to it because there's lots of variations of the heritage overlay. It's not stock standard cookie cut. You'll have some where paint colours are restricted, so you need to keep the colours on the front of the house the way that they've always been. Sometimes the heritage overlay is about an old window that's special, or I've seen heritage overlays for chimneys. And so if you're redesigning or doing a significant renovation on that house, you've got to work around this sacred chimney. But what you do tend to find is heritage overlays come in all shapes and sizes. And Dave, you talked about bigger blocks. We've got heritage overlays in our old working class inner ring suburbs in every city. So if you go into, you know, old suburbs like, for example, Newtown in Sydney or some of our inner north, inner west around here in Melbourne, some of the block sizes, I'm working on comparable sales right now for something that goes to auction in Fitzroy, and it's on 87 square metres of land. It's a double-storey terrace. So we have big blocks, we have little blocks. What we usually find is they're pretty. They're really pretty, they're uniform. And it doesn't mean that you can't do anything. It means you'll jump through a lot more hoops to do something. And in most cases, the streetscape needs to be preserved. So if you're finding that you're planning on doing a second story addition, they might allow it. It might have to be set back towards the back of the house where it's not completely visible from the street. But I'm going to hand this over to Pete because it's completely in his domain. And I'd love you to chat about how people have to jump through hoops and what some of the things they navigate with council are, Pete.
Yeah, look, it's a very interesting field. So I know a developer here in Adelaide who's doing quite a large development in a beachside suburb, and there was a heritage building on the site. It was local heritage, so not as restrictive as, say, being state heritage, but part of his application, he had to find three different heritage architects that said that this particular property was not that significant for the area. Even though it was originally built, let's say in the 1920s, it had a number of additions and extensions, so it wasn't really original character. And then that report goes to council, who has their own heritage architect and has their own opinion. One of the issues with planning, and this is not just in South Australia but all over the country, it's very subjective. You know, it's not just tick the boxes. It's very subjective, you know. So who's going to determine how much it contributes to an area? Unless you've got photographic evidence, who can actually determine when extensions were done, when painting was redone? So it can be very difficult. And you can get around heritage overlays. So if you want to do something to a building Plus, there's requirements for private open space and setbacks and how it contributes to the area and all of these things. Providing you either at least meet or go over the minimum requirements for some other areas, then you may get around that heritage overlay. But that's the same for the other factors. So if there's 10 boxes to tick and you can only tick 9, providing you more than exceed those minimum requirements, there's a chance that you will get it through even though you've ticked 9 out of the 10 boxes.
Well said, Pete. And Dave, I've got to ask you, have you got a heritage overlay on your property?
No.
Okay, because you did some pretty cool renos and you seem to beat me on the timeline. I was wondering why you did it so seamlessly, because it is a very pretty streetscape and you've got a significant, well, you've got 2 masonettes that you've joined now. And I was really wondering who your friend was in council. Well, because our reno was at the
still,
same time.
They're still very strict, I can tell you that. You know, we didn't change our footprint, even putting in entry steps at the front middle of what was a bedroom of the right-hand side masonettes, you know, one of the 2 semi-detached properties, because it was forward ahead of the current footprint of the property, you know, you had to go through council and get approval. The front fence, the gap between the palings on the fence, and, you know, we wanted the fence to be a little bit higher than it is for privacy, but so they're still pretty strict at the local council, even without ours. Although, you know, they were built in 1938, but there's been on the street, there's been a lot of knockdowns and big behemoths being.
Yes, I've seen some Metricon-looking things that French provincial style, which I always think is such a shame when redevelopment strikes. But that is a nice segue into our next segment. Council Development Laws and NIMBY Suburbs. So NIMBY is an acronym for Not In My Backyard. Now, we all say that it's okay as long as it's not next door or over the fence. Pete, can I ask you to elaborate?
Sure. So in the eastern suburbs of Adelaide, Sydney and Melbourne, we have beautiful, expensive suburbs, wide tree-lined streets with lovely houses. Houses are on big blocks, but there's very limited chance that you're going to get a lot of development within those suburbs. One of the reasons is because of the local residents. So generally in planning regulations, whether they're being initiated or even if they're being tested, the local residents will have an input into what they want to see in their local area. And so that helps set the scene. And really, the big one is minimum site area. If you can have as big a minimum site area as possible, then it's very difficult to subdivide blocks of land. So often what these eastern suburbs councils will do is say, look, we understand that you want to increase the density of the metropolitan area, because then that there's less chance of us ripping up arable land on the outskirts of the city. So what they say is, we'll allow for high density on the main roads and around transport hubs, rather than allow medium density within our lovely side streets. So they get around it that way. So generally, state government will often give local councils targets. So you need to increase your density by this much. Just using simple maths, a simple way to do it would be to say, all right, well, every block can be chopped in half if we need to. And if you need to double your density, that's done. But in many of these councils, they don't do that. They'll say, if your block faces a main road, well, you can increase the density by 5 or 6 or 7 times. But if you're in the side streets, there's no subdivision. So that will certainly affect the supply of property, because the reality is most people want to move into the eastern suburbs not to live in some apartment on a main road. They want to live in a beautiful character or period home. So that's one of the reasons those character period homes go up in price so much. Number one, they're not making any more original character or period homes. And number two, there's a pretty good chance that there'll be no other new redevelopment in the area keeping that lovely streetscape.
You make a really good point, Pete, and I'm pretty certain I've said this in other episodes. And when we're looking at what you're allowed to do with land, I get a lot of aspiring developers, not necessarily experienced aspiring developers too. My developer interest ranges from people who have had loads of experience and looking for the ideal site, know what they're doing, have a team around them, have a town planner, all the way through to someone who's read too many magazines and doesn't have enough spare time to even visit the property, let alone take on a project, and everything in between. And I often say to people who don't have the experience and think that it's an easy ticket to manufacture growth, have a really good think about what you're planning on doing. And the other types of buyers that I often deal with are those who are happy to buy an established property as an investment property. And then we get started on the search. I've done the strategy. They throw in a little clanger. Oh, by the way, could we get something on more than 650 square metres because I'd like the option to subdivide? And I have to pull on the brakes and reconvene and have another chat with them because that's a different brief, a really different brief. And to your point, if you're going for something for capital growth, so in other words, you're wanting it to just do its thing, let time do its work, and then you're all of a sudden wanting to combine that with the option one day down the track at an undefined time to do a renovation and a subdivision, well, then you might be conflicting your brief. Because if you're relying on capital growth, and especially in a gentrifying area, if we pick a really good street that has the right attributes to be one of those A-grade streets when this place eventually gentrifies, it might be within easy walking distance to the shops and station. It might be part of an urban plan that's pretty exciting. But if that street is likely to have houses that have their facades protected and subdivision activity is low or nil, to your point, Pete, we'll have the A-grade street with all the big blocks and the houses that eventually get improved. If we're going for something that definitely or most likely has subdivision potential, it's likely that all of the other houses in the street will hold that same potential. And all of a sudden, in 10 years' time, you've got all these cheap-built townhouses that are probably catering to first-time buyers on budgets because, let's face it, it's a gentrifying area, so the price point's likely going to be lower. That could ugly up very quickly, and you'll have renters, lots of cars in the street, cheap-built units that are decaying. Is that really the capital growth strategy that you want to employ? And my message to clients that do want that is make sure you get in first and you do the subdivision first and you sell the first units because you don't want to be selling the 20th block of units.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
And the other reason you want to do it first is just because you bought it today doesn't mean that you can redevelop it next year or the year after, because planning rules change. A great case in point is, I think I've told you that I'm writing a book with Margaret Lomas on small-scale property development, and we're using one of her developments as a case study. When they bought it, she could put 5 on there. By the time she contacted me to do a development, the zoning had changed. She could only do 3, and 3 wasn't profitable. Thankfully, it was a corner site. We were able to keep the existing dwelling and put 1 on at the back, which made it very profitable. I mean, that sounds easy, what I just said. I just said it in 30 words. But, mate, going through council and the fight it took, it makes for very interesting reading. But the point I'm trying to make is if you want something with subdivision potential, you better get that subdivision potential approved sooner rather than later, because zoning's changed.
Really good point. And subsections of zoning can have a significant impact. I know that when I'm looking in particular locations that are ripe for subdivision activity right now, we have a few different strains of general residential and neighbourhood residential zoning. It's not just one or the other. And there are some that will enable you to have, as you said, higher density. And developers are aware of this. So we have to be on our game when we're appraising property too, because if we're in subdivision heartland, and the zoning is not necessarily friendly to a multi-site subdivision, we can anticipate that the prices will be different per square metre. And that's really important to know. So when we talk about supply and demand, well, demand is heightened for the properties that can have more properties put on them when you're in a developer-centric area. And you have to be really aware of who your likely competitive buyers are and what they're planning to do, because you're up against developers and you're not looking to develop it and it's got a zoning that's attracting them like bees to honey, well, then you need to think carefully about what your contingency is if you miss out.
Yeah, 100%. So overall, our government restrictions on red tape around development is one of the key reasons our property values increase to a point where planning and zoning restrictions, the OECD have just put out a paper stating it's one of the core reasons why Australian property values have outstripped in the fourth fastest house price growth out of the world's advanced economies over the past 20 years. So it's going to be interesting because, as you guys are just talking through and alluding to, it's a moving beast. You can't actually be certain about how things are going to change positively or negatively into the future where you purchase property. And obviously there's, you know, to your point about buying to maybe develop long-term down the track, well, that builds in us a high level of uncertainty around your plans, doesn't it? So if you are planning to do some sort of development, as Pete just said, you've only really got certainty in the really near short term. And even in that case with Margaret, you know, it changed from 5 to 3. You'd expect over the longer term, things will gradually free up, but, you know, where will they free up? How long will that take? What will free up first? What will take longer to free up? You know, there's so much uncertainty in this space, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah,
and if you've got a big core of NIMBYs, that's going to take a very long time to free up.
Yeah.
Good stuff, guys. I could talk about the impact of changing zoning and the degrees of flexibility for development activity and also how the urban planning can change things and how that has to be well integrated into your strategy and well understood. But in the interest of time, we're going to move
like
to...
like an episode, Kate.
Yeah, I reckon it could be. I look often on local websites to see, you know, what sort of urban activity, urban planning activity and future plans are being rolled out because they can really start to take shape. I mean, I've watched Footscray very carefully for many years because so much is happening here. Activity zones mean that you can have skyscrapers. So we have to know exactly what streets we're purchasing and how zoning is changing because no one wants a cute little Victorian that's next to a high rise, and that's a really critical point. So I think it is another ep. We're moving on to point number 6, a number and quality of existing stock in terms of existing supply and demand for housing and then new versus established. Dave.
I guess it feeds into what we're just talking about. You know, we've touched on a number of times across our 100-plus episodes how across the overall city you're looking for a population growth, so a location that is attracting people to the city, but on a suburb level, you're looking for stable population because that implies there isn't a high supply of new property. Obviously, if there's a high supply of new property, then more people will be moving into that suburb. So existing supply and demand, well, you know, again, in the NIMBY suburbs where it's much harder to get approval to build new properties and subdivide, well, you've got a high level of demand, but the supply is staying the same. And that ultimately pushes up property. Whereas if we're thinking of, say, a greenfield site on the fringes of a city and there's significant developments being undertaken and then people have moved into those properties, and there's still more available land to be developed, but it hasn't been developed yet because demand has just reached the level of supply. Well, then once that happens, well, that's when the developer will pull the trigger on developing the next bunch of properties. And, you know, all of a sudden there's more shiny new properties. And if you're wanting to sell the house you bought 5 years ago or 3 years ago or 7 years ago, well, the people who are actually wanting to live in that location, they're much more likely to want to buy something brand shiny and new that they can have some sort of say in the layout and the floor plan and the style of the property versus your house that is now 3, 5, 7 years old and dated. And, you know, that's a perfect example of how supply and demand can either help property values grow in a location where there's a low supply and also low population growth versus, say, a fringe suburb example where there is high population growth, but there's also high and more readily available supply to come on tap when it's needed.
Dave, you raise a great point about the fringe and the developing suburbs, and they worry me constantly, particularly if someone's reliant on capital growth in those early years. And for two reasons. The first one is obviously we talk about land to asset ratio, and if the rate of the depreciation of the dwelling is greater than the rate of appreciation of land, that property could go backwards for a little while. And the other thing that worries me is it's a skewed market when we're factoring in government incentives. If a brand new property is more readily accessible to someone because they're getting a grant for it being brand new, that will already devalue a secondhand property. So it is a problem. But to throw the next challenge into the mix, I'm going to get you to comment, Pete. Let's talk about migration, because what we do know is a lot of new arrivals buy brand new. Sometimes it's a cultural decision and other times it's relating to the restrictions around what they can purchase.
Yeah, so if we look at migration in terms of supply and demand and the price of property, people must be wondering, how come our property prices are booming where we virtually had no overseas migration? As you said, Kate, many overseas migrants look for new property because that's what they like. It's a great opportunity to buy a new property or rent a new property because they haven't had the chance to do that in their country of origin. And so demand for new property increases significantly when we have high levels of migration. Can you imagine what's going to happen next year when the international borders open and overseas migration ramps up? What's that going to do to property? Because if I could just give a quick economics 101 lesson, the supply of property is what we call inelastic. That means you can't change that very quickly, but the demand for property is quite elastic. As was a great example is home builder. When Home Builder was announced, demand for property changed the next day. So we had, tens of thousands of people wanting new homes the next day. But you can't supply new homes the next day. That might take another year. That might take an 18 months. That's one of the reasons that property prices go up so quickly in such a short space of time. It's because supply needs to catch up to demand. So hence why the last 18 months have been so huge so far as property prices is concerned, is because there was a huge amount of demand in the first half of last year through Home Builder, but it takes a long time for those houses to be built and people to move in. And on top of that, there has been so much demand, there is a national shortage of building materials, including timber, concrete, and structural steel. So even though there are even though there is enough tradies to do the work, there's not enough materials, which further delays the supply of property. So it's certainly very interesting seeing what's happening right now, because it's a great illustration of how price is affected by demand and supply.
Great point, Pete. What a way to end on supply and demand. I'm going to now, in our last few minutes of our episode, talk about the demand-only drivers. And Dave, to start this segment off, level of infrastructure.
Well, look, the level of infrastructure has an impact on property prices because people want access to good quality amenities, whether that is shopping, whether that is restaurants, cafes, whether it is medical-based hospitals, schools. Certainly infrastructure, easy access to amenities to get around, to get to the CBD, you know.
Yeah.
It all plays a part.
It certainly does. Yeah. If we think about some of our less well done urban expansion, and we can talk about our own city, and I'm sure there are lots of cities out there that suffer from this, I'd argue that our urban sprawl in Melbourne has been mismanaged at a lot of stages. And if you go into some of these new suburbs, can you guys feel it?
Yeah, our house.
Bloody hell. Well, I'm shaking too.
Jeez.
We're having an earthquake.
Jeez.
Far out.
Oh, my God, that was a big one.
Weird.
Very scary.
Still going.
Still going.
I'm going to... The kids are out for a bike.
Yeah. It's bad. I'm going to... Everything's shaking.
Yeah.
Whole building.
Still is stopped.
That was very scary. Everyone's out in the balconies.
So it's finished now? The shaking's finished?
No.
Just about.
That was scary.
Just be back in a sec because...
Yeah.
I'll pause the recording. You come back when you're ready. No problem.
Yeah.
We just rang our daughter who's in Melbourne, and while we're on the phone, our daughter in Canberra sent a text to say that they also had a quake.
Oh, wow.
Canberra as well.
Yeah.
Really weird. That was very scary.
Shall we finish it off so you two can get on with the rest of your day?
Let's prepare yourselves.
If you're wondering what just happened, you may have gathered that the recording was interrupted by the Victorian earthquake. We thought we would leave it in here to give you a bit of an insight into what it felt like and perhaps to give you a chuckle at a couple of the expletives said by one of our hosts, not naming any names. Now back to today's episode.
So we were chatting about level of infrastructure, and it's a really good case in point when we look at cities that have not conducted necessarily the best urban planning when they've expanded their city. And Melbourne is a really good one to look at. Because we've got locations where you are in gridlock traffic and unable to get to work in a timely manner when you've got really difficult streets getting you onto the arterials or when you've got a limited amount of public transport. And some of these end of the train line train stations have the car parks full before 7:30 in the morning. So there's certainly a lot of case studies out there that haven't been done so well, and it highlights the importance of infrastructure when you're looking at a property that's suitable for you. Now, Pete, the availability of services, particularly rural and semi-rural areas, can you touch on this quickly for us?
Yeah, so it can make a big difference. If you imagine, say, two country towns 5 kilometres apart, but one country town has the mains electricity, mains water, either mains sewerage or common effluent, but the other country town, let's say, does have mains electricity, but most people are on rainwater and most people have septic tank. If we just consider those three utilities and everything else is the same, one would imagine there'd be more demand to live in the town that has all of those services connected rather than going to the other, buying a property in the other town where you hope that it rains enough so you've got enough water and you're going to have to clean out your septic tank every year or two. So availability of services, especially in rural or semi-rural areas, is quite important.
Great point. Now, Dave, I want you to chat about employment and underemployment, job availability in industries and how this can create demand for a certain area.
Yeah, so look, I think this is probably best exemplified when you look at the growing gap between what have been coined superstar cities and the other cities around the world. So superstar cities, you know, such as New York, London, Paris, San Francisco, Amsterdam, Stockholm, Berlin, and Sydney and Melbourne have been thrown into that stratosphere as well in Australia and in Auckland in New Zealand. These superstar cities have a wildly disproportionate share of the world's leading high-value industries, high-tech innovation, and attract top talent. A few examples of that is, you know, London accounts for around 25% of all economic value in the UK. So London, in essence, occupies an entirely different economic planet to the rest of the cities in the UK. Even more strikingly, when it comes to high-tech startups, globally, just six city regions, London, San Francisco, New York, Boston, Washington, DC, and San Diego, attract nearly half of all the high-tech venture capital investment across the entire world. Well, that was in 2016. So, you know, another interesting fact is that the 50 largest metro areas across the globe house just 7% of the world's population, but generate 40% of the world's global economic activity. And just one small sliver of San Francisco attracts billions of dollars of venture capital annually, more than any other nation on the planet, except for the USA. So, you know, these factors create an increasingly, I guess, inequality between some cities and others. And also this happens within these cities as well, within different parts of these cities. I think this is one of the reasons why we've seen, you know, in the last 10 years that Pete just took us through the numbers, you know, Sydney and Melbourne were 1 and 2. We've done a previous episode a year or two ago looking at the previous 10 years figures, and Sydney and Melbourne outperformed as well over those 10 years in comparison to each capital city. And if you go back further, that pace of different growth rates has been increasing. And there's just some good examples of why job availability industries attracting high talent is perhaps most obviously plays out in changing residential property values.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you explained that really well, Dave. And it leads on to my second last point, income levels. Now, from a demand point of view, income levels, can you expand on how this fits in?
People's living expenses don't change as proportionately as their income levels can. And so what that means is when you have cities, and it sort of feeds into what we were just talking about, where the average or there's a much higher percentage of high to very high income levels, well, the amount of spare cash that then can be put towards investing, which obviously includes property, is disproportionate. And therefore, that also helps drive up property values in those areas. And, you know, again, that's another reason why, say, a Sydney or Melbourne has consistently outperformed the other capital cities in Australia. And, yeah, and it's certainly why we strive with, you know, our clients when we're developing a property plan to aim to own property in one or both of those capital cities, if it's affordable to them, as a starting point for developing their portfolio.
Amazing. So I'm going to swing the microphone over to Pete for our last point on demand drivers. And this is for all of the investors out there, rental returns and vacancy rates. Pete, how does this have an impact on demand?
So when investors can see that rents are increasing significantly and vacancy rates are decreasing, so it's very easy to get a tenant and it's relatively easy to get a top rent and continue to increase that rent, then there's more likely to be demand for investment properties. Now, we're having that at the moment. In my opinion, it's not necessarily driven by the rental returns and the vacancy rates. It's driven by the fact that first-time buyers have quickly left the market because first-time incentives have disappeared and their places are being taken by investors. So there's a number of factors that impact on rental returns and vacancy rates. Again, you would imagine that without overseas migration, how can our vacancy rates be so low and how can our rents be increasing so much? But that's because the property market is complex. I know I've used this analogy a few times. The property market's like a garden. It's not just one element. It's not like you turn on the tap and water comes out. It's not that simple. There are a number of factors that will help determine the price of the property. Demand and supply are the two biggest factors, but there are many factors that go into creating demand and also many factors that go into creating supply.
Yeah, it's a great point, Pete. I think vacancy rates is something that every investor needs to be very mindful of before they go into an area. And yes, if you've got a township or a city that is plagued by high vacancy rates, that will absolutely have a direct impact on the desirability of picking that area as an investment. And if it's an investment-centric township already, that's when we can see capital growth values come off and sometimes go into negative when all of a sudden a township is plagued by vacancies. And that can be as a result of a major employer going under. There are lots of reasons why, when looking at smaller townships and towns that have a minimal number of major employers, that you do have to approach this kind of strategy with caution. Now, on that note, with an earthquake in between, we've navigated today well, recording this on the 22nd of September. I'd like to ask you both to put on your thinking caps and come back with your gold nuggets.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Dave, over to you.
So with migration, you've got international migration, which has been on hold for the last 18 months, except for expats, interstate migration, intrastate migration, and intra-city migration, which is essentially gentrification. What's been quite interesting is the capital city, greater capital city internal migrations and how those numbers have changed since COVID started. So Sydney, for example, was already losing about 8,000 people per quarter. Melbourne was about 2,000. So Melbourne now, in the last quarter, has lost 8,273 people, or to the March 21 quarter, and Sydney 8,169. So Sydney was give or take the same level as it was prior to COVID, but Melbourne's now caught up with Sydney, and Brisbane has taken a lot of the people leaving Melbourne and Sydney. So Brisbane was getting about an extra 1,800 people, and now that's gone up to 4,770 at the December 20 quarter, 3,274 in the March quarter. Perth also is getting some of them. So they were about 1,800 in the December quarter and 1,500 in the March quarter. Whereas most of the other cities were pretty consistent where they were. But that doesn't tell the whole story, because who are the people leaving and leaving Melbourne and Sydney? Are they the high income earners, the top talent, or are they people who are perhaps struggling to afford to live there? You need to look beneath that data. And why do Melbourne and Sydney keep growing in population even though they're losing people? Well, that's generally because of overseas migration, because most new migrants to Australia end up living in Melbourne and Sydney.
And we're having babies.
Yeah. So the point I'm making here is there is numbers within numbers within numbers. And you've got to sort of look a bit deeper, and just one high level number might tell you, oh, look, everyone's leaving Melbourne and Sydney, but it's not necessarily going to be a negative impact on property values. And we've seen that already, because there might be lower to middle income earners who are leaving and higher income earners and coming in, and it doesn't factor in potentially the international migrants who make up the lion's share of new entrants to particularly Sydney and Melbourne, for example.
Nicely said, and world's longest gold nugget ever. Your turn, Pete.
Okay, I'm going to keep mine short and sweet. So you want to know why property prices are skyrocketing at the moment in relation to demand and supply? If you look at the latest CoreLogic data, I won't go through every state. Nationally, there are 28% less properties for sale today than there were a year ago. But interestingly, there are 42% more sales than there was a year ago. Now, admittedly, a year ago, we were still coming to terms with COVID-19. But if you look at the five-year average, generally, over the last 5 years, there's about 40,000 properties sold. Most recently, there's about 55,000. Now, that is a huge increase despite there being a huge decrease in supply. So even if demand stayed the same, property prices are going to go up. As I said before, the property market and property prices is a complex field. So you need to have a look at all the factors and how they impact on property and property prices.
Wonderful. Been so good to see you guys, and glad you're my lifelines while we had our little quake. Hope everyone's all right. And I look forward to seeing you next week.
Okay. Check you later.
See you guys.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to know more about planning for your next property decision, take a listen to episode number 4, How to Develop Your Property Plan. Start with the end in mind. Episode number 6, What Determines Your Property Strategy. Episode number 19, Time in the Market versus Timing the Market. And episode number 22, Why the Family Home is Often the Biggest Piece of the Investment Puzzle.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
and the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.